The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we ask how the UK's judicial system is expected to adapt to the nuances of the internet age, thanks to an alleged joke that's been taken very, very seriously indeed. We find out about the latest battles between smartphone and tablet manufacturers, and we gaze into the Tech Weekly crystal ball to predict the success or failure of Windows 8, Microsoft's next desktop operating system. Joining me to parse each of these problems in turn is technology editor Charles Arthur. Charles, welcome.
Hello.
Now, this week, the week that we're recording, is, of course, the week of Lerv.
The day is Valentine's Day.
It is, but we're non-day specific here. Charles, I'm curious. Your personal Lerv app, which would you choose?
My personal Lerv app is actually speech. What? I've got to say, you know, just talking to people.
Actual conversation.
Yeah, you know. You know, possibly with a slight little, you know, glass of red wine or things like that, candlelight. You know, it sounds really boring, but actually it's really effective.
I'm slightly embarrassed hearing about your modus operandi, Charles. So maybe we should just move swiftly on.
Yeah, okay, I'll put the bottle of red wine on the desk.
Okay. Oh, golly. Charles, you're also going to be speaking with Graham Parker, Intel's UK MD, about their Ultrabook in this podcast and how they compare with other products on the market. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In January 2010, Paul Chambers made a comment on the public platform Twitter that he claims was a joke. Frustrated by the cancellation of a flight because of ice and snow on the runway at his local airport, he tweeted, "Crap! Robin Hood Airport is closed. You've got a week and a bit to get your shit together, otherwise I'm blowing the airport sky high." Now, the joke was at first ignored, and then it was instantly and rapidly taken very seriously by the police, and now it's become known as the Twitter joke trial. It's made an epic ascent to the High Court. Despite the protests of an incredulous mob, under the Communications Act of 2003, Chambers was convicted of causing a menace in May 2010. Joining us on the line are writer Graham Linehan and Observer columnist Nick Cohen. Welcome to you both, and thank you both very much for joining us. Graham, you've been campaigning to raise money to support Paul Chambers' trial and appeal. Tell me a little bit about the last 2 years of history in this case.
I'm very much, a Twitter activist on all this. I only recently went to one of the appeals, so I'm not sure I can take you through very exhaustively what's been happening.
So what was this appeal, the one that you went to?
He's gone to the High Court now. Essentially what happened is, I presume they expected Paul just to take his punishment and go away, but because this has become such a cause amongst people who, you know, have a basic level of kind of internet savvy, we've been just raising enough money to keep some lawyers involved. David Alan Green has been doing it, I think, for free. The appeal process takes a kind of basic amount of money that we've just... I did a concert thing to help out, and Al Murray's been helping out as well.
Why are you so engaged with this, though, Graham? Why is there such a rabble that's seeking to support Paul in this?
Because it's so desperately unfair. It's so unfair. It could have happened to anyone. The kind of joke that, and it's not really a joke, let's face it, it's kind of more a kind of exasperated blurt, you know? It's certainly not a funny joke, but it could have happened to any of us. We've all had that feeling, but more importantly, we've all phrased something in a way that could be if taken seriously by Jobsworth or silly people, that any of us could have gotten into trouble in this way. And it's just so unfair that the finger of fate has just landed on Paul and could ruin his life. You know, he's lost two jobs since it happened. He's known in some sections of the press as a bomb hoaxer, which is ridiculous. And what I want to do is just fight it along with anyone else interested in the case until it feels like the world makes sense again. Because I really can't live in a world like this one.
Nick, what does this say about the UK's judicial system's ability to keep up with the latest trends in communication technologies?
Nothing very flattering. There's that. It also tells you about
the danger of catch-all laws. Paul was done under a section of the 2003 Communication Act, which makes an offence to send by electronic communication networks any message that is grossly offensive, indecent, obscene, or menacing. Now, everyone sent messages like that, or messages that could be interpreted like that. I mean, in Paul's case, he was just engaged in the usual sort of mock bombast we engage in. You know, you might say, or a colleague of yours might say, if I go home and find my boyfriend hasn't cleaned the house, I'll kill him. You don't actually mean you're going to kill him. And the danger of catch-all legislation is not that everyone is prosecuted on it. It means the authorities can use it to get people they don't like. In Paul's case, I mean, trying to work out why this ludicrous legal juggernaut is ploughing on is quite difficult. I think it's because the airport security and police made fools of themselves and sort of knew they were making fools themselves at the time. The reason this came up with Twitter, you can search Twitter. So if you wanted to do an ego search of Twitter, Alex, you could put your name in and see who's mentioned you or your articles and doubtless find thousands and thousands of people praising you to the heavens. And what happened was, a manager at Robin Hood Airport just searched Robin Hood Airport. He came across this. He didn't take it seriously, but the regulations say he had to pass it on. He passed it on to the security manager, who didn't take it seriously, but the regulations said he had to pass it on. He then passed it on to police, who go and arrest Paul with four officers and you know, all sirens blaring. His employers then fire him because they think, you know, they've got a criminal on their hands. And then they passed on to the Crown Prosecution Service, possibly because they were just irritated at having wasted their time.
Graham, could I put this question to you and to Nick as well? Okay, you're saying yes, but he's you know, there's no, it's a bad joke. Say Abu Qatada, who was released yesterday, the radical cleric who's been convicted of no crime in the UK. What if he were to tweet that?
Oh, that is a good question. I don't know.
Well, I do, actually. Abu Qatada has a record going back years of inciting hatred, of inciting violence. In the late 90s, virtually every suicide bomber in the West had tape of his sermons. When the police went round to their house, often they found tapes of his sermons inciting pathological hatred. You know, he has form, and a sensible police force would take notice of that. Paul Chambers has no form whatsoever. Indeed, in the whole history of aviation, no one has ever blown up an airport because snow has closed its runways. It's about context and common sense policing.
Context is a really important thing. And Graham, it feels to me that people have jumped in support of Paul because there is no form. There is no, you know, previous encounter with this kind of thing. But what does this, what if, for example, somebody creates an online persona which is a rabble rouser, or, you know, says, come on folks, let's go and post something on Facebook and says, you know, let's gather and have a riot here, or, you know, let's blow up Robin Hood Airport. The online context is pretty important. So how do you divorce that online persona, who could be, you know, bombastic or whatever, from somebody who is just having a laugh?
One of the things that came up during the trial was the shouting fire in the crowded cinema argument, you know. And the thing is, whenever I hear these other situations posited, I kind of think, well, that's not this situation. Why are we talking about a different situation, you know? And it seems to me that one thing that's happened is that individual voices have become are suddenly being heard now, because this is a new landscape, a new media landscape, where suddenly individual voices are being transmitted. And it just seems to me that a kind of broad legislation for all these individual voices doesn't work. As Nick says, you do have to have a degree of, you know, sense in how you deal with things. I always say that the way that this whole thing could have stopped, and it would have stopped, would have been if a policeman on Twitter, there weren't many policemen on Twitter, you know, until recently, suddenly there's loads. But if a policeman on Twitter was to send Paul a message saying, sorry, mate, I know you're only having a laugh, but could you take that down? Because some people could take it seriously. And it would have been over right there. So it's a question of, you know, fighting these things out in the court, but just doing the kind of day-to-day work of policing, which is not just arresting people, but sometimes just advising people, talking to people, and forming a relationship with people. That's what didn't happen here.
Nick, this, what Graham's proposing, is a kind of digital literacy that it seems that many people aren't engaging with, forgetting that, for example,
yes,
Twitter is a public platform. So, you know, what is the negotiation here? Is it that the courts and law officials have to adapt, or is it that individuals have to adapt?
I hope individuals don't have to adapt, because we could become a lot more frightened society. I mean, to me, this case shows something very interesting. Graham talked about the good side of the web. I mean, giving people voices, making everyone, if you like, a journalist, or anyone can be a comedian, anyone can make a video and show it. The enabling democratic side of the web. The other side of the web, it's Jaina's face, if you like, is it puts out vast amounts of information about people that before would have been terribly hard to find. You know, 20 years ago, If Graham and I had left a pub and we were very, very drunk and someone had taken a picture of us, it wasn't very flattering, that would be in a photo album. Even if we'd been arrested and done for being drunk and disorderly, there would be a public record that we buried in a police file or in a local newspaper cutting archive. Now the web gives indelible evidence against people on a vast scale. And if the police and the authorities, and employers as well, employers are using Facebook to police and punish employees, if they're going to take that evidence and treat it all with the seriousness with which they treated this nonsensical charge against Paul Chambers, we're going to become a lot more frightened and suspicious society. People are going to be careful what they write online. They're going to be careful what other people do. They're going to get nervous if someone makes a nasty comment about them in the blog. And the web, far from being a liberating phenomenon, will be a stifling and crippling one.
Well, actually, I think there's a flip side to that, which actually might be a bit more optimistic. Dan Savage was talking about the, I don't know if you know him, he's a kind of very net-savvy sex columnist in the USA. He invented the double meaning for Santorum. He was talking about the Anthony Weiner case, who he sent his picture of his unit to someone on Twitter, you know, and lost, and had to retire, had to quit and stuff like that. But Dan Savage said, in about 20 years, that won't happen because everyone's penis will be on the internet. And his point is that what's going to happen is human nature is actually going to change as people realize, you know what, if you get drunk when you're 18 and you show your breasts at a party or whatever it happens to be, you don't have anything to be ashamed of. And I think that that's the flip side.
Peter Singer, the philosopher, has made a very similar argument to that we will become less ashamed. Other people know more about us, but we'll know more about them. It'll come out in the wash.
Unfortunately, for Paul Chambers, though, is that we're not 10 years in the future when everybody's got their wits out online.
Alex says that there's a very strong argument against that. It neglects power in society. It neglects hierarchy. It may well be that your employer has behaved just as badly as you've behaved. It may well be that it's worse. But if they can use that to sack you or demote you, they will. Internet democracy and a hierarchical society don't necessarily go together very well. And until we're more egalitarian about it, until an employee cannot be fired for writing something on Facebook, this is a case in Manchester at the moment of someone I profoundly disagree with him, but I believe in freedom of speech. He was a worker at a housing trust. He's very Christian. He writes on his own Facebook page that he's opposed to gay marriage. And the Trafford Housing Trust demote him and cut his salary by, I think it's £14,000 a year. He's got a rolling £14,000 fine for expressing his views in the free country. Now, 20 years ago, you wouldn't be able to do that. This chap would have probably gone to his evangelical church and come up with all kinds of opinions, as I say, which I disapprove of. But, it's in a free country, I should be able to argue with him to convince him to change his mind. Now his employers can use that evidence against him. And so I hope Graham's right, and I hope we become a freer and more open world, and you can see the web pushing in that direction. in lots of interesting ways. But Paul's seen the reverse side of that.
One final question. Graham, what do you think the long-term effect is going to be for web users because of this trial? Do you think it's going to break the solipsism bubble, our relationship between us and computer and the three people that we think we're communicating with? Or do you think that we're simply going to adapt and open up our identities as Mark Zuckerberg suggests?
What I think is happening is I think this is a transitional time that is proving very painful for all manner of people. The music industry is finding it very painful. They don't know how to deal with what's going on. The judiciary and the CPS are obviously finding it very painful because they brought this ridiculous trial and now they can't back off. And Paul is finding it very painful because he's caught in the kind of grinding wheels of history, you know? And I just think that, unfortunately, we are going to see a lot of these things happen. And then eventually, I think it's going to change for the better because I really don't think the internet can be stopped. I think that the overall usefulness of connecting us all is so huge and such a game changer for the human race that I just don't think it can be. I think eventually it'll win out, you know.
Graham, I'm afraid I'm going to have to stop you there, but on that optimistic note, thank you both, Graham and Nick. You can follow the Twitter joke trial coverage and commentary at guardian.co.uk/technology and guardian.co.uk/law. In business news this week, Charles, you've been reporting on the antitrust battles that are happening in the European Commission over so-called essential patents, including those enforced by smartphone manufacturers Samsung and Motorola against Apple. Now, the current situation, as far as I understand, is that the two smaller companies are accused of abusing their positions as owners of essential patents, which have to be licensed under fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory, or FRAND, terms to all comers who want to build to a particular standard. But there's a row now brewing in the US and Europe over this. So Charles, what actually is happening in Europe?
Well, on Monday evening, the European Commission approved the takeover of Motorola Mobility, known as MMI, by Google. And on the same evening, the US Department of Justice also cleared it. So there's only a couple of reasonable ones. China has to approve it, Israel and one other country, I think, have to approve it. But pretty much those are the big ones. So Google can pretty much now reckon that it's sealed the deal, $12.5 billion acquisition of MMI. So what is happening, though, is that Apple, as you know, has various lawsuits going on in the US and in Europe and in a number of other countries, including Australia, against Samsung and HTC and a number of other companies. Motorola is suing Apple in Germany. It's also suing it in the US. Samsung has hit back at Apple with a number of lawsuits. But the thing that's been really big and the thing that's brought the EC in particularly is that Joaquin Almunia, who is the competition commissioner in Europe, as a coda to the approval of the Google-Motorola merger, said, we're going to keep a watch on what Motorola is doing with essential patents, and the way that it's behaved in the past is not necessarily a guide to the future. We will, you know, we'll be looking at this very carefully. The US Department of Justice said the same. It said it was not entirely clear what Google's statements about the use of essential patents once it owns them from Motorola was, and it felt more comforted by what Apple and Microsoft were saying.
So all of this, there's a whole bunch of information in here.
Yes.
Really focusing on this essential patents issue and this relationship between the essential patents and the ownership by, mm-hmm. say, for example, Google or Apple or whomever, and FRAND, this, you know, fair and reasonable use, in some ways almost like an open license, so anybody can use them. Is
it
that
is.
Right?
It's meant to be that if you want to build to a standard, so Motorola were the first to build a mobile phone, so they have a lot of patents related to mobile phones. The idea is that standards bodies say, okay, this patent is essential. If you're going to build a mobile phone, it has to do these things. So in return for making your standard your patent essential, it means you have to license it to all comers on these FRAND terms, fair, reasonable, non-discriminatory. And it's also meant to be an irrevocable license. And for example, Motorola has licensed Qualcomm, which makes chips for the iPhone. Qualcomm has licensed a number of the patents that are used to Qualcomm. However, on January the 11th, Motorola wrote to Qualcomm and said, as far as Apple's concerned, no, they can't have these patents. And Apple has filed a lawsuit in the States saying, whoa, you can't do this under Fran. You cannot revoke to a particular third party. And Qualcomm agrees. Qualcomm is saying, I'm sorry, Motorola, but you know, you guys have given us a license. We can now sell to anyone that we like. Motorola is arguing that Apple does not have a license. Qualcomm is saying that under the principle it's called patent exhaustion, once it has sold a license to Qualcomm, Qualcomm can then sell on to anyone it likes. There's no ban on doing
but
that.
Aren't all patents Fran?
Nope, not all patents are Fran. So the patents that Apple is arguing about with people like HTC relate to patents such as when you see a number on your phone screen, if it appears as a hyperlink, you can press that and it will dial it. That's not Fran. That's not in every phone. That's not in every device. Apple keeps it as one of the things that makes its devices special. So although Apple does have some Fran patents, it is committed to the IEEE, which is a standards body in the US, to making those available on Fran terms. But you know, some patents, it doesn't keep on that way. So not everyone is obliged to license all patents. But if you put a patent into standards, if you agree to license under Fran, because then you get the benefit because everyone pays you when they build to a standard, then you have to, you know, lump it when, you know, people who you don't like, people you're having a commercial fight with, use the patent as well.
Speaking of commercial fights, is this not Apple just having a bit of sour grapes over the success of the Android, of Google's systems, or you know, the Galaxy Nexus in the US?
Well, there's two separate things here. Apple is annoyed at what it sees as copying by a lot of Android handsets, Android implementations. So HTC, it's taken to court. Samsung is doing similar. A number of the issues with Samsung are over what's called trade dress. It's saying the Galaxy Tab looks too much like the iPad, which is a separate issue. That's not patents. That's about look. But in terms of patents, yes, it's saying the way that this is done, that's our patent. Therefore, this is infringing. But what Samsung and Motorola have done, and Samsung is being investigated by Almunia's department, Samsung said, OK, Apple, well, if you're going to sue us, then we're going to withdraw this Fran patent from you. You can't use it anymore. And a European court said, no, you can't do that. And Almunia's department is investigating Samsung for antitrust abuse. And that can be really expensive. If you're found guilty of antitrust abuse, you can be fined up to 10% of your global turnover in the EU, and that's really not a place you want to be.
That's a real sort of, I can see that as a business killer.
So the thing is, for Google, owning Motorola, great, Motorola's got lots of essential patents, but those essential patents cannot be withheld unreasonably.
The Fran model, the Fran scaffolding, seems to be in place to allow innovation, to allow small players come in and use,
yes,
these different systems.
Absolutely.
So what is this finding? What are the implications of what's been happening in Europe for opening up the market to anybody other than the major players at the minute?
Well, the implications are that if this sort of stuff was allowed, you know, if you're allowed to withhold Fran patents in this way, then that makes it much harder for new players to emerge, because people will be saying, yeah, you have to build to the standard, but actually we're gonna screw you for the money. So if Apple, for example, had to pay twice over, you know, once in buying the Qualcomm chips, which embody the cost of the Fran patents, and then again to Motorola for using the patents, That's effectively, you know, increasing Apple's expenses unfairly. And you know, you can see why Apple would be rather annoyed. And that's why they filed what is in effect an antitrust suit in the US, which they're hoping to get transferred to Europe. And if it comes to the attention of the DOJ in the US and to Almunia in the EC, then things get really expensive really quickly for Google. So it's not a place that Google wants to be. You know, they're going to have to learn to play nice as far as the Fran patent goes. Now, with other patents, you know, things where Motorola hasn't licensed them as standards essential, where they're, you know, some way that the phone behaves, which is entirely up to them, great, you know, go ahead. Where you find infringement, sue for them. But, you know, so far the weather has all been on Apple's side. You know, got to say that it's been winning more of these sorts of battles than it has been losing. And where Samsung, for example, and Motorola have been making headway against it, there have been questions about, you know, this Fran abuse.
Well, you can read more on that at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally in the news this week, Microsoft's next desktop operating system, Windows 8, is expected to be ready for release later this year. And as the date approaches, the technology blogosphere is beginning to ramp up its opinions based on the information publicly available. And also conjecture, perhaps. But, you know, we wouldn't want to say that. Last week, ZDNet, and I will say ZDNet instead of ZDNet, ZDNet's Stephen J. Von Nichols made a compelling case that the OS will be DOA. And amongst his criticisms, like no one needs it and it's not pretty, he offered a couple of arguments that actually could stick. Is the developer community being sidelined? And is this new operating system too late for the handheld market? Charles, I am curious. What has prompted the release of an entirely new operating system only 3 years after the last one? This is a pattern that seems similar to Vista, which, you know, what was their reasoning then, and how is that different to now?
Well, Microsoft needs to push the whole operating system, you know, needs to push Windows along rather as it, you know, pushes out new versions of Office, just because new capabilities come along in chips, people have new use cases, people want to do different things, there are different ways of working, you get new technologies like solid-state disks come into wider use. So where, you know, Windows XP was pretty good for its time, 2001, and actually is still used by a lot of people.
A whole lot of people. In fact, Windows 7 is it hasn't necessarily... I read somewhere that the uptake really increased last year.
Yeah, Windows 7 only started getting corporate, you know, uptake last year. And there's still a lot who are still on XP, you know, on corporates. Vista didn't make a big impression because, as much as anything, Microsoft had to do a big reset in the middle of it and basically rewrite it and chuck big chunks out. Windows 7, in effect, was Vista Plus, or, you know, the Vista reimagined.
Vista Shiny.
Yeah, and, you know, Vista Worky. but Windows 8 is really rethought. And the thing here is that Microsoft is trying to get this to be desktop, laptop, but also tablet. And not only that, they're going from not just Intel chips and AMD chips, the whole x86 instruction set, but also now on ARM chips, the same sort that you find in smartphones and tablets. So it's a really big step by Microsoft, but it's been forced on them by the rise of the iPad and the whole tablet phenomenon.
So is that really the new thing, this movement towards devices that are more portable?
Oh, absolutely. This is really the thing about Windows 8, is that it's not just your desktop and your laptop, but it's also your tablets. It might even be on certain sort of reader-type devices. There have been some rumours about it even being sort of pushed down to the smartphone level, but then again, one hears suggestions that that's not really going to happen, that it's all you have is the interface that looks the same, the Metro interface, which is a sort of very tiled appearance.
Yeah, the Metro interface is what is it? You know, I mean, more pertinently, why is it?
What is it is easy to answer. Windows which don't have borders, so they call it content, not Chrome, is one of the slogans that the Microsoft designers use. And it's much bigger targets, much bigger elements on the screen. So rather than the little icons that you've been grown used to with, you know, from Windows 3.1 onwards, really you're talking about very large targets now, much more for a sort of a touch screen sort of world, and also one where the tiles that they are can update. As to why, well, it makes it look different. You know, tiles have been, you know, the little icons have been around, like I say, since, you know, Windows.
And those are like the little Windows, folders, yeah, and
exactly,
stuff that you've
all those
got on your
little
desktop.
Things that clutter up your desktop, and you say, Jesus, I cannot find anything here. The whole idea of tiles is that it gets the whole file system out of your way. You're not thinking about about folders and stuff. Actually, instead, you're meant to be thinking about applications and just use. So it's your mail, it's your calendar, it's all those sorts of things in front of you. Even though Windows 8 and Windows 8 on ARM and on tablets will have a sort of rudimentary file manager, even though it will sort of have a desktop so it can run in Office, the idea is that you swoop through all your different applications and your different uses, and that really you don't go near the file manager at all.
What about the relationship between Microsoft and developers at the minute? How is Windows 8 being received by the developer community?
It's really quiet out there. Matthew Baxter Reynolds, who is one of our contributors and who's a, you know, great Windows fan himself and who has been watching this, says that WinRT, which is the Windows runtime environment that you have to develop in, there's just no chatter about it. People don't seem to be talking about it in the way that you would expect them to need to be doing if they're going to be developing for Windows 8 and developing, you know, rewriting things in Metro. Because one of the big things about Windows 8 on tablets, on these ARM tablets, is you're going to have to recompile and rewrite any old apps. They will not run as they are on those tablets. So, you know, if you have a sort of a 3 or 4 year old FTP application, which you think would be really nifty on a tablet, ain't going to run unless you rewrite it and recompile it with that Windows on ARM as a tablet, as a target.
Well, we will obviously keep our eyes on this as it unfolds, but you can catch up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. The Intel Ultrabook is a light, sleek, high-performance notebook computer that aims to distract consumers from the bullish tablet market and perhaps Apple's MacBook Air. Charles met Graham Palmer, Intel's UK Managing Director, to talk through the features of the machine and how much it can retain foothold in an increasingly saturated market.
So, Graham, the Ultrabook is essentially a class of laptops, and the idea is that they're going to be thin and light and that they're going to boot up fast. Not necessarily cheap. Why, you know, what's the thinking here?
Well, let's take that piece by piece, Charles. I think you're absolutely right that the Ultrabook is a new category of personal computers. And in fact, what Intel feels we're doing is reinventing the personal computer. The Ultrabook comes with a lot of, you know, great new features that are really exciting. As you mentioned, super thin and light, you know, below 0.8 of an inch thick, which is very nice to carry around. Very fast startup. So, you know, if you're just opening the lid within maybe 3 seconds, there you are presented with your sign-on screen, or maybe even 8 seconds from a deep, deep sleep, which gives you an extended battery life. So that's great. Also, we're adding to that, of course, great performance that you would expect from Intel, but also great security. We're seeing, you know, as we talk to consumers and businesses, not only do they want great portability, great performance, but they also want increasing security to make sure that their data is secure. And equally, if the device is lost or stolen, they can then ultimately disable that device remotely. And that, again, is features that are being built into this new category of Ultrabooks.
So on the security side, it just happens to be the case that Intel spent many billions buying McAfee the other year. So one can see why you might find happy confluence on the security side. But is there actually a clear demand from people for a whole new class of device in this way? Or did you simply look across and see Apple selling lots of MacBook Airs and think, oh, we'd like a piece of that?
Well, a number of points you raised there. One is that Apple is a great customer for us, and we're delighted with that relationship. The security one is absolutely from feedback from our customers, both business and consumer. The acquisition of McAfee was a part of that strategy. It didn't essentially drive that strategy. It was the other way around, that we realized that what Intel could bring to the market was a range of different devices that all communicate together, be it from your Ultrabook through to a netbook, a laptop, a desktop, through to your in-car connected devices, through to your smartphones in the future. All of these things connecting seamlessly to, you know, cloud-based services. In order to do that, you need great connectivity between all of these things. You need great performance. Intel has clearly got the performance. We acquired Infineon's mobile communications element, so we have the connectivity. And the third pillar is security. People want to be confident that as their devices are seamlessly and transparently talking to each other, so your Ultrabook is synchronizing with your smartphone, let's say, you want to be confident that that data, your personal data, is secure.
So does this mean that
between devices?
Does this mean that all the laptops that are being used out there are not secure?
There are varying degrees of security. So, of course, we're all familiar, or many of us hopefully familiar, with hard disk encryption, so PGP, all of these different types of advanced encryption. But we're really taking that to another level to allow you to, for example, with anti-theft technology, be able to remotely disable your laptops if it's stolen or lost. If you leave it on the bus or the train, or, you know, unfortunately somebody steals it, you would be able to call up your service provider, let's say a telco or the retailer that sold you the device, just as you can with a smartphone today, and say, hey, my smartphone's been stolen, can you disable it? You'll be able to do that same capability with your Ultrabook in the future, and indeed many other mobile devices as well.
So Ultrabooks are not the cheapest laptop. They're sort of at the $900 and up in the US, which puts them into pretty much the premium sort of end. With PC sales slipping in the West and in Europe, PC sales overall fell by, I think, 16% in the fourth quarter, and the US saw a similar sort of slide. are you really going to be able to get this market moving, or is this just trying to sort of increase the profit margins for a few companies?
Well, ultrabooks really just started to appear in the market a couple of months before Christmas. We're starting to see more and more devices appearing on the market. We'll certainly see more configurations appearing through 2012. And I think there are upwards of 70 different designs from different manufacturers coming to the market. As you pointed out at Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas in January, huge buzz around the breadth of different devices and the innovation that the PC industry is bringing to ultrabooks. I think, you know, we're going to see a whole range of different devices that will undoubtedly move into more mainstream price points, but the experience that we're bringing to consumers today really does warrant a premium device. We're seeing very, very sleek, fast startup, secure devices, you know, much more attractive.
But equally, you know, if you're not selling, if fewer PCs are being sold, how do you persuade people to spend the money? I mean, if they don't have the money, if people simply are buying fewer computers, are they really going to spring for this sort of extra cash here?
Well, I think the notion that fewer computers are being sold is actually a false one, because if you look at the overall global market, there's upwards of a million PCs per day being consumed. So we're still seeing, you know, high single-digit, double-digit growth of personal computer consumption per year.
I've got to say, that's not the figure that I've seen from Gartner IDC. You suggested something in the low, below 5% for the whole of 2011.
Yeah, and again, an interesting observation in that Intel's view is that because we have a global touch and reach into all of our channels, both in the rapidly growing emerging markets, the BRIC markets, for example, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and those types of markets, in addition to Western Europe, we feel our view of the market through 2011 actually, you know, was a little more bullish than some of the market watchers viewed. And ultimately, we saw that come out in our full year performance. So actually, we are confident that we are still seeing good growth in the overall PC business. So to say that PC growth is, declining or volumes are declining, That wouldn't be true, because actually there's a huge amount of growth still happening in many emerging markets. To say in the Western European and North American consumer markets, for example, that the business is challenging would absolutely be true. And that's why bringing more innovation and excitement and a new experience to consumers and businesses in those markets will absolutely drive new interest, new opportunity for people to buy into this new category of ultrabooks that we brought to the market.
Now, Intel is funding ultrabook makers to some extent, isn't it? You've got a marketing plan where you're, in effect, providing some millions of dollars of funding to the ultrabook makers to encourage them to do this.
No, again, I think that's a little bit of misinterpretation of the information that Intel has shared. One, we've created a $300 million fund to help drive innovation around the ultrabook category. And as you can imagine, as you create a device that's 0.8 of an inch thick, that has to start up quickly, there's a lot of new types of device that need to be developed and evolved, and technology for the cases, for the screens, for the keyboards, that needs to really have an injection of investment to drive that innovation more quickly.
So Intel, what are you doing? Tooling up the factories? I mean, I would have thought they knew how to make screens already, that the cases haven't been a problem, because Sony had a Vaio, which was 0.8 of an inch thick. Lenovo was doing much the same. They were beating the MacBook Air back in 2008.
Well, actually, I think, again, a good point. Whilst we've seen pockets of innovation, what we're bringing with the ultrabook category is enabling the broad market, all of our PC manufacturers, to bring these new category of devices to the marketplace. So you do in fact need to invest in all of those different types of physical elements of a device, the electronics that goes within them, so that you can make them smaller, etc., and consume less power. For example, we recently announced a screen technology that will reduce the power consumption of screens, which will of course give you longer battery life. So through Intel Capital, which is Intel's venture capital and investment arm, we created this $300 million fund that we will use to invest in businesses who are creating these new technologies that will, for the second and third and fourth generations of ultrabooks, bring new innovation to this category.
So does Apple get some of this $300 million? Do they get to play as well?
Well, again, we wouldn't talk specifically about different manufacturers. It's more that the intent and the action on our part is that we're very serious about ultrabooks because of the feedback we're seeing from our customers.
But do you classify, for example, the MacBook Air as an ultrabook?
Well, an ultrabook is a PC category. The MacBook Air is already in the market, of course. You need to speak to Apple about how they're evolving their products.
So, sorry, when you say PC category, you mean a Windows? It's running
Windows. It's a Windows-based device that we're
seeing
today.
So an ultrabook has to be running Windows?
Well, the category will evolve. We're only in the first generation of these devices. Who knows what will come next? But of course, you know, as we see our first generation here today, we'll see more innovation coming in the second generation and third generations are already on the drawing board for the next 12 months and 24 months.
But I'm intrigued by this. You're saying that the MacBook Air doesn't qualify as an Ultrabook because it's not running Windows. I mean, they can run Windows. You can, you know, that's one of the things that The Verge did for example. The other day, they said, okay, well, let's look at this. Let's run Windows on a MacBook Air and see how it goes.
No, actually, what I'm saying, Charles, is that the initial tranche of Ultrabooks are all Windows-based, we've seen in the marketplace. What comes in the future, who knows where that will go? And of course, we work with all of our partners to allow them to benefit from all of the investments that Intel is making across all the different technologies.
So with the screen technology, the thing to give the longer battery life, that would become available to Apple, would it?
Well, that would be available to all of our customers. And again, we wouldn't get into specifics of which customers would choose to take that. One of the, you know, the situation that Intel is very familiar with is enabling many, many different manufacturers to embrace the technology we're bringing to the market. Another example would be Thunderbolt technology, which is essentially USB on steroids.
This is, you know, an Intel technology.
This is an Intel technology.
Which Apple has already started to integrate into its device.
Which we make available to all of our manufacturers. And different manufacturers make individual choices to how that suits their different product lineups.
Why do you think Apple has gone for Thunderbolt sooner than other makers?
You'd need to speak to Apple about their choices and indeed the other manufacturers. But
how many others besides Apple have started incorporating?
Thunderbolt is clearly a very interesting, exciting technology for the future. So we're
talking
to all of our
manufacturers. How many are already shipping?
It's too early to speculate on what will happen through 2012. But of course, it's a very interesting technology. We'll see many manufacturers embracing and bringing into the marketplace because it's a really exciting new innovation.
I'm sort of hearing zero as the answer to how many are already shipping.
No, what you should really be hearing, Charles, is actually we're not specific about who will be bringing that to the market because we don't want to pre-announce what our customers will do.
But Apple already does ship devices with Thunderbolt, and I'm wondering how many others, you know, Windows PC manufacturers are already shipping Thunderbolt, given that, you know, it must be beneficial to you to have a larger ecosystem going around Thunderbolt. You know, once there are more Thunderbolt screens, Thunderbolt, you know, hookups and so on, that would be better. But I'm sort of wondering where your partners are there. Or do they need another $100 million of encouragement to make that happen?
Well, again, I would say, so the money that we talked about earlier is about driving innovation so that we can drive the different elements of the platform forward more quickly to bring more innovation to our customers, and ultimately that's what Intel is really focusing in on. As far as Thunderbolt is concerned, again, it is a fantastic new innovative technology. Different manufacturers absolutely will embrace it in accordance with their own product plans. Because it is such an attractive and exciting technology, they will embrace it as they go through their own product refreshes.
Feels a bit like USB, where Intel developed it. It was known to be a really good idea, and yet it took Apple to unveil the iMac and say, okay, we're binning all our old connectors, here's USB, to make it actually get a kickstart in the marketplace.
You know, it takes me back, Charles, when we talk about USB, because I was the chipset guy selling chipsets to the manufacturers in Europe when we launched USB, and everybody, you know, across frankly the media and many areas said, why are you building USB into the platform because there are no peripherals for it? And again, that's an illustration of what Intel brings to the marketplace. We deploy enormous volumes of these technologies that kickstart whole industries around the PC category. And that, again, Thunderbolt's a great example. Ultrabook's another example where we'll see more and more innovation joining this new category that we're bringing to the marketplace as we enable other industries to bring new innovation, be it around perceptual computing so that you can start to talk to your Ultrabook, you can start to use gestures to control it. All of these things are new innovations that we'll bring to that platform. But the USB is a great historical example where, as a test case, where we brought that innovation to the marketplace, different manufacturers embraced it at different times, but now none of us would be without it because it's just a utility on all platforms.
There's a strange symbiosis, isn't there, between Apple and Intel, which goes back, yeah, as you say, there's USB, there's also Wi-Fi, where Apple was one of the first to introduce it, and of course Intel had Centrino, and now we've got Thunderbolt, where, again, Apple has been the first to adopt it. And indeed, with the MacBook Air, which is the Ultrabook, you know, basically is the Ultrabook, but a few years earlier. That's a strange sort of parallel life that the two seem to have been leading there.
Well, certainly, Apple are a wonderful customer for Intel, and we're delighted with that relationship. But I would say, you know, as you look at the Ultrabooks that have appeared in Q4, calendar Q4 just before Christmas, with the likes of Asus and Acer, Lenovo, Samsung, etc., bringing products into the marketplace. Again, a huge amount of innovation that these manufacturers are bringing into the marketplace. And, you know, personally, I've been using an Ultrabook for the last 30 days or so, traveled to the US twice. Fantastic device to have. whilst I've been used to having a small, thin and light laptop for a long time, having an ultrabook in my bag is really a revelation, because it's really just like having a magazine in your bag in terms of physical size. Just a great device to really free up you to use a device in exactly the way that you would like it to be used, and also a device that sits in your backpack or your bag that really you hardly notice it's there. So it's again a real experience that Ultrabook is bringing. And you know, one interesting comment I heard about the PC category is that it's really the ultimate Darwinian device, in that it continually evolves to the needs of the user, to the opportunity in the marketplace. And Ultrabook is yet another illustration that we're bringing a new category of computing to consumers and businesses.
And yet it's not quite a Darwinian ecosystem, is it? Because you're very much being the intelligent designer there. Intel is the one herding all the cats of the PC manufacturers and saying, you know, we think this Ultrabook thing is a really good idea. Here's $300 million, which is going to help you to devise the technologies. Because I think we can probably take it as read, can't we, that if that $300 million of investment cash hadn't been there, Ultrabooks would not have happened in this way by themselves.
Again, I think you're mixing two elements up here, Charles. One is that you're right that Intel has a lead role in the PC industry to innovate and bring new technology into the market. The technology which goes inside computers is very much driven by Intel's innovation and research and development investment. That then allows our partners and customers to innovate in the form factor that they bring into the marketplace. And we have to work in tight partnership to make that happen. Now, there are a number of other industries sitting around our direct supply chain, if you like. For example, the case materials that are used, the screens, the keyboards, all of the super slim devices that would need to be generated and created to go inside Ultrabooks. We have to look at how can we allow those businesses to move more quickly forward, because as large volumes start to appear in the marketplace, we need to make sure that all of the companion components are also there to allow our industry to deliver this great innovation into both businesses and consumers.
Looking more generally at the laptop market, the netbook is dying off pretty quickly. The low-cost Atom-using device is really starting just to fade out of the market, and it's really quite a fast fade as tablets are just chewing up the low end there. Do you think that within, say, a year that Ultrabooks will have replaced the netbook, that they will be selling as many as netbooks are selling now?
So Ultrabooks, netbooks, two different things. I think a netbook and a tablet are great consumption devices, companion devices for consuming internet content and a little bit of creation, whereas your personal computer is the primary device that allows you to create and consume in equal amounts. So generally the trend is that a netbook or a tablet would accompany a PC, a laptop or an Ultrabook as your primary device. And in fact, we continue to see good growth across the market. You're right in that netbooks have declined in Western European markets. We've seen that. But actually, they've found a level now where they service a need within the marketplace at a particular price point and a form factor that, you know, is certainly one that is well established now in the 2 years or so that netbook have been in the market. So again, back to the Darwinian comment, lots of innovation and creativity across the PC space, from netbooks, tablets, all the way through to the new Ultrabook category. So I don't see that these things are in conflict. I see that they complement each other. And it's an illustration of the continuing differing needs and evolving needs of both businesses and consumers.
Give us a forecast. A year from now, or perhaps Q4 of 2012, what proportion of laptop sales will be Ultrabooks?
Oh, I think we're very bullish about Ultrabooks into the marketplace. You know,
give us a bullish forecast.
Well, we've just started. So, you know, from a consumer perspective, we've started in consumer. Businesses will come later in 2012. So I would expect, you know, to be well into the double digits of percentages of overall notebook sales would be Ultrabooks, which shows our ambition.
More than 10 isn't very ambitious.
I said greater than
20?
Into double digits. So well into
30?
Strong growth in that space. And certainly 40, the initial 50? Response from retailers is very
positive. Put a number
positive.
To it, Graham. Put a number.
No, I'm not going to be drawn on it, Charles. But
well,
what
you said double digits, but that's
what
only 10.
See our intent. For example, we will start TV advertising in the UK around this category in the next 30 days or so, or maybe a little longer. A lot of in-store retail activity really starting to ramp as more and more manufacturers come into the marketplace. So the fact that so many manufacturers are moving into this space illustrates they see it as a great opportunity, we see it as a great opportunity. The feedback from consumers, and I think you were at CES, the buzz around Ultrabooks was fantastic. You know, a real genuine buzz, which was wonderful to see for our category. So I'm very excited. The response from retailers, again, very positive. So I think we're on a track to a great success with this new category and reinvigorating the PC space.
Graham Palmer of Intel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Graham. You can find out more about how the MacBook Air compares with the Intel Ultrabook at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks very much to Charles, to Graham Linehan, to Nick Coham, and Graham Palmer. If you want to get in touch, then head to guardian.co.uk/techweekly for all the social and the anti-social options, including links to our Facebook page, Twitter page, email address, etc., etc., etc. The producer this week was Simon Barnard. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we are back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.